It's easy to get caught up in debates about the Muslim world, especially questions about religious doctrine. So it may be refreshing to look back at one of the world's great mystics, the Sufi poet Rumi. Rumi lived in the 13th century on the eastern edge of the Persian Empire, eventually settling in what is now Turkey. And he left a remarkable cache of poetry and spiritual wisdom. Today, Rumi is, quite remarkably, one of America's best-selling poets, thanks largely to his longtime translator, Coleman Barks. And Strange Champs talked with Barks about the insights of Rumi.
You've spent so much time with this poetry, becoming the bridge, bringing Rumi back to us here in the 21st century. What's your sense of what it's like to be inside a Rumi poem?
Well, it feels like I've been released from a cage into the air, kind of sense of freedom. There are many metaphors for that kind of spaciousness, an ocean with no shore.
Maybe you should read something.
let's see. Okay. I am so small, I can barely be seen. How can this great love be inside me? Look at your eyes. They're small, but they see enormous things. So often he'll do that. He'll ask a question, how can this great love be inside me? And then he'll give an image that is an answer. It's the way the eye contains the night sky. In that same way, the great love can be inside a small human being.
You know, Rumi is... He's the great poet of the Sufi tradition, and maybe we could talk a little bit about what that means. Some people I know describe Sufism as the inner mystical side of Islam.
Uh-huh.
What did it mean in Rumi's day to be an Islamic mystic, a Sufi?
Well, I have a different sort of take on that. I just think it's the way of the heart. He keeps saying it's beyond religion, so it's beyond what we usually think of as Christianity or Islam or Judaism. All those isms, it's beyond ism. That sort of frees it up. I think that's what makes him so available.
It's striking that Rumi kind of doesn't really fit within the doctrines of any particular religious tradition or one who would maybe want to explode all religious dogmas and doctrines.
Well, that's my take on him, yeah.
People like that, religious authorities tend not to like to own up to. So I guess I was wondering if Rumi had particular conflicts?
Well, not so much, because his personality evidently was so gentle and so inclusive that he just couldn't be attacked. He had such authority within his own gentleness. So he could say things that are wildly subversive. And for example, he said, if you think that it's important to call yourself a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim or a Hindu or a Buddhist, if you think those are important ways of dividing up in the world, then you're making a division between your heart and how you act in the world. So it's such a wildly subversive thing to say, even now. And he was saying it in the 13th century when the Crusades were coming through his country, you know. It's amazing they didn't kill him. But evidently he had something about him, like St. Francis. You couldn't attack him.
The great teachers, the great mystics, I guess, speak to people beyond the bounds of their specific religions. But,
uh-huh.
You know, remind us who Rumi is or was. Was he raised in this mystical tradition, or is it, you know, was there a kind of blinding insight that came to him?
The central event in Rumi's life is his meeting with Shams Tabriz, this wild mystic that maybe we don't have anything comparable in the Western world to Shams. It may be like Thoreau to the 500th power, Dostoevsky to the 20th.
Wild-haired visionary?
Well, there was that part of him, and he was just a deeply lonely man. He wanted a companion who was on his own level. And a voice came to him once and said, your friend is Jalaluddin of Konya. And so he went to Konya and met Rumi. And they were together for, say, 3 years probably. And then Shams disappeared. The one story is that he was murdered by jealous disciples of Rumi. Another is that he left in order that Rumi would be compelled to move in a deeper direction.
Why would his leaving compel Rumi to grow deeper?
There's something about grief, isn't there, that takes us deeper. The poems come out of grief as well as a deep ecstatic joy of the interconnectedness of all things.
Rumi wrote about his grief about the loss of Shams.
Yeah.
He writes about searching for him, and he writes about feeling that he has moved beyond the search because he knows that he holds Shams in his heart.
Somehow he is the friendship. He moves beyond the pronouns.
Is there a poem that comes to mind that...
The one that's I, you, he, she, we, you, they, in the garden of mystic lovers, these are not true distinctions. I, you, he, she, we, you, they, in the garden of mystic lovers, in that realm of consciousness that he's trying to take us into, the pronouns are not true distinctions.
Hmm.
We interconnect in ways that language can't quite say.
Here in the West, we have this long tradition of separating two different kinds of knowing. You know, the kind of knowing we do with our rational minds, that's part of the scientific method,
mm-hmm.
Enlightenment thinking. We tend to separate that from the intuitive, non-rational, mystical way of knowing. Would Rumi have made that distinction?
Maybe not. He's a kind of a scientist of consciousness. He tries to study experience. You know, he's really talking about the nature of love or the nature of friendship. His poems try to help us experience that. That's why the Sufis have no doctrine. All they have is what they've experienced. He says that the longing is for the longing itself. We didn't want to hear that, did we? The longing, you know, we're longing for something we already have. Longing. It's like redefining God. So what we thought we were longing for God, but now we already are that, and yet we long for it.
Do you have favorite quatrains in this section?
Let's see. As you start out on the way appears. As you cease to be, true life begins. As you grow smaller, the world cannot contain you. You will be shown a being that has no you inside it.
And he does that same motion of an image of something very, very tiny and compressed and contained, and then he explodes it into something that's...
Uh-huh.
You know.
As you cease to be, true life begins. All the great religious traditions try to say what that is, you know, how it is when the ego dissolves and you just have the rose light of the dawn coming up or something, you know. He keeps trying to find images for that.
Oh, read the next one. I love the next one with the image of the fish and the sea.
Dear mind, such a traveler, always moving, like a fish looking for the sea. That's the joke, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The fish is looking for the sea. While the great heart's ocean waits all around and inside it, how can you live outside this love?
That's beautiful.
Someone asked my teacher once, Bawa Muhyiddin, what it was like for him to be alive. And he said, it's like driving a car. You're inside and you're tending to things, but you're also the landscape you're driving through. And like the fish, the ocean is inside the fish, and the fish is looking for the sea.
Coleman Barks is America's best-known translator of Rumi. He spoke with Anstrain Champs about his book, Rumi, The Big Red Book. For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Can Islam and Science Coexist? Is part of our special series, Science and the Search for Meaning, Five Questions, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio. Original theme music for the series was written by Steve Mullen at Walk West Productions. For more information on this series and to find additional material about the topics we've explored, please go to our website at ttbook.org/scienceandmeaning. And special thanks to two of our sponsors for Science and the Search for Meaning, the John Templeton Foundation, supporting science, investing in the big questions, and Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science.
PRI, Public Radio International.